Crystal, I am incredibly excited for what we have going on today. We have Thomas Frank, who was a very influential author for me. One of the first political books I read was What's the Matter with Kansas? And I think it really helped shape my ideology. I don't know if it was What's the Matter with Kansas or Listen Liberal for you, but it was a big book for you, right?
Oh, yeah. What's the Matter with Kansas and Listen Liberal and his new book, The People Know, have all been extraordinarily influential for me. And What's the Matter with Kansas was one of the first political books I read, too.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. That's the same for both of us. But I haven't read The People Know yet. I plan on reading his new book as well, because he's one of the few writers who, like, he's fantastic, and I swear by it. I haven't read anything from him that I've disliked yet, so I'm really excited to talk to him. This is a big deal for me. But before we get into what's happening this week, and there's a lot of stuff happening this week, I just want to tell everybody that this is the last week for the free video version of Crystal, Kyle, and Friends. So everybody's been seeing that on the Secular Talk YouTube channel. If you want to keep getting the video version of Crystal, Kyle, and Friends, you go to Substack. I'll have the link in the video description box. And it's $5 a month, and then you get the video, and you get it a day early. So you get it Friday night, and then the audio will always be available to everybody, and it's going to come out a day later, so the audio will come out on Saturday night. But this is the last week for the free video version of Crystal, Kyle, and Friends. So if you want to keep getting the video, you tip us $5 on Substack per month. Again, link in the video description box if you want to check that out. But again, if you want to listen audio only, then that comes out on virtually every single podcast platform that there is, and it'll come out Saturday night. So I just need to give everybody that heads up. Next week we have, can I say this yet?
Sure. Yeah,
okay, I'm going to say it. I'm going to say it, Crystal.
There's no backing out now.
Next week we have the amazing, brilliant Nina Turner. And now it's Nina Turner running for Congress, which is incredibly exciting. I'm really, really excited about her campaign.
If she can win for Congress, and I think she has a really good shot. I mean, she's running in a Democratic primary. She's raising good money. She's got obviously an incredible profile nationally, which we know about. But she also has a really incredible profile locally based on being in state politics for a lot of years and the work that she's done in the community there. So I think she has a good shot. And, you know, just having her in Congress as a new leader in, you know, the progressive movement there, it could actually genuinely be a monumental shift that has direct ramifications in terms of what's able to be accomplished through the House this year. So very exciting. I just love her as a person.
I love her too, but yeah. I agree with you. I think it's a game changer if she gets in there, because I think the quality that she has that is lacking in D.C. now, even though there are some politicians I respect and I like there, is leadership. I don't see the leadership that I want. I don't see somebody who's willing to take the hatred, willing to take the fire, willing to have Pelosi hate her, willing to have the media hate her. You know, she's already been through it with the Bernie campaign.
Yeah.
They hated her for being associated with the Bernie campaign. So she's like, okay, I've been through this before. Go ahead, hit me with everything you got. I don't care. Whereas other politicians, I won't mention any names, but they care what the media thinks of them.
Right.
And that categorically changes it. But anyway.
She's fierce.
She is.
That's the word.
She's incredible in every way. Trump's impeached.
Yes.
A second time. Massive, as I said on Twitter, massive cuck energy to be impeached twice and to lose the popular vote twice. That's a first in U.S. history.
Yeah.
I think even just losing the popular vote twice is a first, I think, right? Am I wrong about that?
I have to have a brain that's working better than mine is
mine
right now.
Mine sucks too.
Let's just go with that. We'll go with it. I mean, yeah, and especially like on the one hand, you looked at the Biden campaign and you were like, you could barely beat this guy, like who destroyed the country, did nothing about COVID, was an utter disaster on every level. You barely beat this guy. On the other hand, you look at Trump and you're like, wait, you couldn't beat Joe Biden? Even like as an incumbent president who, you know, generally always get reelected, you couldn't get past Joe Biden. So it's kind of like embarrassing all the way around. And it's sort of like that with impeachment this week. There's two ways to look at it. On the one hand, you had 10 Republicans defect and vote for his impeachment, including Liz Cheney, who got all kinds of media praise for being so brave. So on the one hand, you're like, only 10? Like, the guy helped incite an insurrection on the Capitol. You people were all, like, had your lives endangered by this man, and only 10 of you are willing to vote for impeachment. On the other hand, you look at it, this was actually the most bipartisan impeachment in history, because Nixon resigned before he was impeached. So, you know, there would have been more Republicans there, but this was, it's very unusual to have your own party vote for your impeachment. So in that way, it actually actually is a historic rebuke.
So let me ask you this. How many do you think the Republicans are going to get in the Senate?
No idea.
No idea?
I really think, so look, this goes to, and just to lay the groundwork, which people already know, you've had a few people come out and basically say that they're on board. They're the normal characters. Toomey looks like he'll go there. Murkowski, Collins, Romney.
Yeah.
You've got a batch that are probably going to vote to convict in the Senate. McConnell has been really quiet and has really left it open. There are a bunch of media reports this week that he was more than 50% leaning in favor of conviction. And look, McConnell is not some moral actor. Right. We should not expect that he's like taking a stand of righteousness here. He's making a very explicit calculation. His power is derived from the power of the Republican Party. Republican Party prospers, he prospers. So right now he's calculating, am I better off ripping off the Band-Aid of Trumpism now, actually banning him so he can't run for office again, so he doesn't like rule the party for the next 4 years, and we sort of start over and figure out how to move forward and do basically what the elites in the Republican Party want? Or am I going to continue to kind of try to ride out this tiger, try to muddle through, try to rescue the scraps of the elites who are willing to go along with insanity even as they're running the opposite direction as fast as they can? What's my best move on the chessboard here? The reality is, I think, no matter what he picks, and my assumption here is that if McConnell votes to convict, he's going to have a decent number of Republicans to go along with him, and it is entirely possible, if not likely, that Trump is actually convicted in the Senate. But I think no matter what he picks, the Republican Party is screwed. They're, you know, they no longer can keep together their coalition of the elites who supported and enabled this party because they were happy to get their tax cuts and their deregulation and all of this. And the base that's been fed on like culture war grievance, they can no longer keep these two pieces together. So I think they're screwed either way.
Okay, so I agree with you on that point. I think they're screwed either way, without a doubt. I just cannot fathom they get 16 in the Senate. I don't think they have 16. I would be floored if they got 16 Republican senators on mm-hmm. board for impeachment. Now, having said that, to your point about how they're screwed either way, oh, no question. Listen, here's what happened. Trump lost his aura of invincibility. If anything, now the conventional wisdom is the exact opposite, that he's toxic.
He's a loser.
And you want to distance yourself from him as much as possible.
Yeah.
But the more important point is what's happening with corporate America, where every corporation is like, Republicans? I hate Republicans. I don't know what you guys talk about. Republicans. I never donate to any Republicans. I don't even know what you guys mean by that. And so they just cut off all the money overnight. Like every big corporation was just like, we're hardcore Democratic, not giving any more money to any of the Republicans. And like, that is what McConnell cares about. That is what's everything to Mitch McConnell. Mm-hmm. His whole existence, his whole career has been, I'm the money guy for the GOP. In the same way that Nancy Pelosi is like the money woman for the Democrats, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's his whole thing, is we represent corporate America. And yes, now they're in a no-win situation, because if you get the corporate money back, well, that means you do have to throw Trump under the bus in some way,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
But to throw Trump under the bus in any way means there's 30% of the base, the 30% chunk of the country, which makes up the hardcore Trump base, that are going to hate McConnell and hate the Republicans.
Yeah.
So there is no winning, no matter what, he's screwed, which is why I think Republican civil war is inevitable.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, you look at Trump's approval ratings since he incited an insurrection on the Capitol, and they have fallen significantly.
29% now.
But that's even within the Republican Party, I mean, the poll that I was looking at, he still has like 75% approval. And you look routinely, you ask Republicans, are they more loyal to the Republican Party or to Donald Trump? And overwhelmingly, they say Donald Trump. So that's the bind that they find themselves in. On the other hand, and look, by the way, I agree with you in your skepticism that they can ultimately get to the 17 votes that they would ultimately need. But if you were going to make a case for it, you'd say, okay, you've got a few people who are actually moral actors who really are thinking it through and trying to come to a place of doing the right thing. I would say Mitt Romney is one of those types of people, and he has some political freedom to be able to do that. Then you think about people who are retiring, who are just like, fuck this, I'm done. I'm just going to say what I want. And by the way, I need to secure my position in potential corporate America for my like afterlife once I'm done being a politician. So you have those types of people. You have people who are in swing states where they may feel some pressure electorally, not just from the ones that you're hosed with are the ones that only feel the pressure from the right wing and are worried about their primary. But you do have some people who are up in states where it's not a given that Republicans are going to win. And so letting Trump get by with this may ultimately be a political liability for them. So those are kind of the baskets of people that I think you have to think about and work with. And you also have people who, you know, McConnell has a lot of tools at his disposal, a lot of things he can promise. If he actually wanted to get this done, he's got a lot of things he can promise. He's got a lot of loyalty within the caucus. So those are kind of the pieces to work with. But you look, I think right likely, like you said, like we're both saying here, no matter what they do, they're kind of totally hosed. I think they were on track to probably have a very good midterm election, potentially take back the House, probably take back the Senate. I think those dreams are totally dashed. And it's not only because of Trump. It's also because Biden has a tremendous opportunity here to just be like, better than Trump. The bar's been set so low. If he just effectively distributes a vaccine and actually gets people checks in their accounts, I think people are going to be like, oh my God, this guy's amazing. This is incredible. But, and by the way, there aren't like armed guards locking down the Capitol right now. This is an incredible dramatic departure.
Yeah, although they're already semi-backpedaling on the $2,000 checks.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that.
Right. So, you know, they were saying 2,000, 2,000, 2,000. Now they switched that to a total of 2,000. So you already got 600. So what happened was 1,400 more, whatever.
That's perfect.
No, I mean, Biden was campaigning in Georgia. This was after they already got the $600 through, and he was saying, we're going to do $2,000 checks. That would be a total of $2,600. But now they backed off of that because they're Democrats. Somebody made a good point on Twitter. They were like, we went like 10 days without people on Twitter being mad at the Democrats. And so they were like, well, we got to do something here. And so they reduced it.
Well, it's just such a perfect own goal. Like, it's so simple. You actually stumbled into what was a powerful political message that actually it was good for you politically. It was something that was super popular, something that would actually have tremendous benefit to people. And you've got to suddenly negotiate with yourself and muddle the message and make it this super, like, it's just perfectly sort of democratic, technocratic answer. Well, if you add together the 600 with the 1,400, then really what you end up with is the 2,000 that we promised. It's like, people want to do that. Why are you parsing this? Why are you negotiating with yourself?
I don't think they want to do
it.
Because they don't want to do it. I don't think any of them want to. I don't think the Republicans want to do it. I don't think the Democrats want to do it. There's an argument that, oh, this is sort of a matter of necessity. And yes, maybe the corporate overlords are like, people actually do need cash right now in order to keep this economy functioning.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just feel like the Republicans and the Democrats effectively don't want to do it because that's something that actually helps regular people. And when are they ever in favor of stuff that helps regular people?
Yeah, so they always have to, like, how can we knock this down a little bit?
Yes, exactly.
Like, how can we not quite make good on the promise? And look, this is why people don't trust politicians. It's like, you told me $2,000. It was as straightforward as it could possibly be. And now you're quibbling and, like, making a point of making it less than what was pledged. It's crazy. And then the other piece of this that I think is really insane is if your goal is to actually get something done is, you know, Biden has this bipartisanship fetish. It's like the one thing
that he's just
completely obsessed with, that he talks about all the time, just like reflexively, even after 8 years of watching Republicans obstruct, stand in their way of doing absolutely anything in the Obama administration. So rather than saying, look, here's our plan and we can do it through budget reconciliation, which only requires Democrats. We're going. And if you want to come on board, great, get on board. No, they want to go out and try to get the 9 Republicans on board to actually pass it through regular order. It is never going to happen. So why are we playing these fantasy games?
See, now I'm going to be the bad guy, but I have to say it. My conspiracy is, I'm not saying I fully believe this, but there's a chance this is real. They don't even really want this package to get through. It's the virtue signal package of, like, look at all these great things we put in this package. We're in favor of these great things. Oh, we couldn't get to 60? Well, I knew that for sure that was going to happen, but I proposed it anyway. But you're still going to give me credit because I proposed it, right? That's what I think is going on, because you're right. They could do budget reconciliation, $2,000 checks, done, you're the heroes of the world, but they didn't do it. They chose not to do it. They went with the virtue signal package, trying to get bipartisan support, which is not going to happen. So it's a waste of time. And it's classic, you're right, it's classic Democrats. It's like, how could we take a sure winner and massively fuck it up?
Right, and, like, confuse the issue, make it a billion times more complicated. Because here's the other path. Let's say you're bipartisan Biden. You want to show the country coming together. You might have 9 Republicans to support $2,000 checks. You at least have some Republicans to support just the $2,000 checks. Marco Rubio is already on the record saying, hey, I want Biden to do $2,000 checks right away. Presumably Josh Hawley, who's been pushing for direct cash aid.
You don't have 9.
You have a better shot at 9 if you're doing. And here's the other thing. So I think you're right. Like this is not a serious attempt to get a bill passed.
Yes.
They like the virtue signaling.
Yes.
They get to be the good guys. The Republicans get to be the bad guys. They're the ones standing in the way. But you would probably still have that messaging, and it would be a lot clearer if you were just trying to do the $2,000 check in this bipartisan way, because then you can just clearly make, the Republicans are standing in the way. They are blocking these $2,000 checks. And then you go and do it through budget reconciliation anyway. So the Republicans are clearly the bad guys. But when you put all this crap together, and I don't want to call it crap, because there's actually a lot of really good stuff in here.
But the messaging gets muddled.
But it gets messy, and then they can surely pick out something that they hate and make it about that. And then you don't have even a clear hit, which seems to be their whole goal, is to have a messaging win.
I couldn't agree with you more that, yes, if you're going to go the route of let's get the 60 and avoid the filibuster and, try to overcome a filibuster. Yeah. Why wouldn't you just do the 2000 that way? Why do you have to overcomplicate this? But anyway, this is all very relevant, very pertinent to the amazing guest that we're going to talk to. So Thomas Frank, I mean, he really is. You and I are two of very few people in the country who are cool with labeling ourselves populists.
Yeah.
And this is a guy who's basically an expert on populism.
Yeah. And I think for me, certainly, that choice of the word populist is very intentional and something that I adopted as both because the term has been really corrupted in the Trump era in particular, where he is supposedly this representation of populism, which is obviously
complete
and utter bullshit. And Thomas Frank is the expert in what is the real history of populism, which was born here in America and has really important roots, left-wing roots, this coalition of white and black working class people and farmers joining together in their shared mutual interests. So we want to talk to him about that, about everything that's been going on here at the Capitol, how that's going to be used by the forces of anti-populism, what's going to happen with the Republican Party, all things that he can certainly address.
Right. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump into it. Here's Thomas Frank.
Thomas Frank, welcome. So good to see you. I have to say, your book's probably the most influential in my political thinking and development. So all of the things that I'm wrong about, it's your fault. Straight up.
Well, I was going to say thank you. That's very kind of you. But, with that caveat, I don't know about that.
I mean, Crystal and I are actually, this is what I was just about to tell you. Crystal and I are probably two of 6 people total in the country who actually gladly use the label populist to describe ourselves. I feel like I'm just going to jump right into it and ask him a question, because this is on the top of my mind. How do you respond to now the word populist is used in a smear way where they try to equate Bernie and Trump and say they're both populists?
It's very useful in that sense.
Right.
Yeah,
populism,
but what do you make of it being
fascism.
A smear now? Whereas previously, obviously the history of populism better than anybody. When previously it wasn't a smear at all. Now it's viewed with a negative connotation in elite circles. What do you make of that?
It's come and gone for a long time, but I want to just throw an amusing fact out there. Barack Obama referred to himself as a populist.
Really?
Yeah. In about
I didn't know that.
It was towards the end of his presidency. It might even have been in 2016, and then he was at a press conference in Canada that he did this, and he said, a lot of the things that he also referred to Bernie as a populist. He said you should stop using the word populist to describe Trump. Trump is not a populist.
Use it for Bernie.
Bernie is a populist. A lot of the things that I did were populist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A few months later, he was using it the same as everybody else does. Populism means, mob rule, means he's crazy, paranoid, Trump supporters, that kind of thing. So even he gave up on it right away. The last president to use that word to describe himself before Obama was Jimmy Carter.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't know Carter that was Carter used it in a positive way. Carter, okay. but it was he meant it as in this really vague, like up with people kind of thing. Like right, I like people,
in like in an Oprah Winfrey yeah. kind of way, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But this is also, I mean, one of the things that you track in your new book is that this is an intentional strategy to smear the idea that ordinary people should have any say in our government.
Yes.
And to make the idea of populism a sort of evil and unqualified, unmitigated bad thing is actually an intentional strategy.
Yes. Or it, with a lot of these people, you know, I don't want to sound like it's a conspiracy. These are intellectuals and this word is floating around in the ether in intellectual life. Like these are political scientists, politicians, that kind of thing. And they hear the word and they start using it in that way. And everybody else is using it in that way. So why not? Because it gets the job done. But it's not like they've actually thought it through. That's my job. Mm. And I wanted to trace how the word became, how the word went from being this sort of wonderful thing, you know, this great movement, to being this dreadful, awful thing that we deplore and fear and hate. And the first thing you discover is that a lot of people hated populism at the time. I mean, the people who invented the word uppercase P, populism. And despite what people will tell you, it is an American word. It was made up by people from Kansas, by people from my home state. Mm. The word was made up one day in 1891 in order to describe a brand new political party, the last great third party movement. And this was, if you're a liberal or a left winger today, you would look ordinarily, you'd look back at this movement, at populism, and you'd say, wow, those were some people who were really ahead of their time. We're calling for all kinds of government regulation of the economy. They were calling for an income tax. They were calling for votes for women. And they were one of the very first, if not, I think, the first ever to say that the black and white working classes should get together because their interests are the same rather, you know, overcome what divides them and get together on these. And this is real. They were way ahead of their time.
So would you say that the label is maybe somewhat interchangeable with like social democrat? What's
okay,
the closest
so this is
tradition to populism?
Basically, from today's vantage point, sure, why not? So look, people at the time argued about this, and historians in like the 1930s argued about the, and they would split hairs about different left-wing factions and tendencies. But look, nowadays, you know, we live in a world where there basically is no left, so fine with me, yeah. And there's also, you know, populism did call for some socialist things. They wanted to nationalize the railroads, nationalize the telegraph, the telephones, that kind of thing.
Were they for democratic control of companies or no?
Or
is
they
that
were
a bridge too far?
That I don't know about. They were extremely hostile to monopolies.
Okay.
So, but they wanted government to break up monopolies in various ways. And but I don't know about anything further than that. Now, the socialists at the time and socialists in the 1930s would say, yes, but they were a movement of predominantly of farmers. Farmers, especially in a place like Kansas, are landowners. They usually or they often own the land that they were farming on. So therefore, they're not a real socialist movement. But look, they come up at the same time as the Labour Party in England. They identify with the Labour Party in England. They identify with the Labour Party in Australia, Social Democrats in Germany. It's basically all part of the same global movement. What's funny is that we're the only one of those countries that doesn't have a real left
that
party, because this was it, and they died.
So,
they got
killed. So what happened to the movement? Was it just like absorbed into the broader Democratic Party, and then the Democratic Party took the neoliberal turn with Bill Clinton? Is that what happened, more or less?
Yeah, it's a long story, but yes, basically the Democratic Party absorbed them in 1896 with a very watered down version of their of what the populists were demanding.
It's very democratic of them. That's exactly what they do.
They're still playing that game.
Exactly.
But it worked, and the populists they got on board with the Democratic train. This is William Jennings Bryan, was a Democratic candidate. He lost, to their great surprise, because everybody thought, you know, he's this man of destiny, this incredible orator, you know, and he lost. And then the populists go to fighting with one another. lots of sectarian infighting.
The left infighting?
Yeah.
I've never heard of this.
And that's the end of them. And so they basically go back to the parties that they originally came from. Some of them go over to the very brand new American Socialist Party, like Eugene Debs,
right.
who's a populist.
Yeah.
He signs up with that. And that's by the way, that's the reason that if you ever study the history of the socialist movement in America, don't know why you do that, but I mean, it's kind of interesting. They were very strong in Oklahoma. It was their best state.
Really?
Yeah.
So interesting.
It's because of populism, because they inherited the populist message.
And so what in terms of, I mean, this was one of the few times in American history where you really had a black and white multiracial working class coming together and having some success.
Well, trying to come together.
Trying to come together.
It didn't work out really.
So what happened there? Because I think that also has a lot of relevance to today, and we can talk about that.
Oh, yeah. It's, I mean, it's a on the one hand, a hopeful story, and on the other, a disastrous story. Hopeful because it was the first time and one of the only times that a political party has – I mean, look, we do this routinely nowadays. The Democrats routinely go to – you know, are able to bring together black workers and white workers. Well, I shouldn't take too much for granted. They try to. The populists were the first to do this, and in the 1890s, this was extremely shocking. And by the way, they were upfront about this. They were right out in the open about it. They said, you know, the interests of black farmers and white farmers are identical. They should be voting for the same candidates, and they should get reforms that help them both out. And they did act on it in some places, and they triggered an extraordinary backlash, just unbelievable. You know, the South at the time was dominated by one party. It was the Democrats. Back then, they were openly racist.
Yeah, the Dixiecrats, sure.
Well, they called them the Bourbon Democrats at the time. Dixiecrats is a later – I mean, it doesn't really matter.
Right. No, I got you. Gotcha.
By the way, just an aside here. The other day I was reading – oh, I forget what mainstream publication, but the article started off, the ancient Greeks detested populism. They're talking about the riot in the capital. Like the ancient, now we know why the ancient Greeks hated populism.
Oh.
No, the ancient Greeks actually did not have that word. It didn't come
did not
until
exist
1891.
Everything I don't like is populism, said the elite publication.
I think it was the New York Times, but it might have been the Washington Post. It called Emperor Caligula a populist. I know.
What?
Like
every terrible world leader I've seen described as a populist. Duterte is one they love to call a populist.
Yep.
Anybody who's like loud, there's like, oh, it's populism.
Yeah. Anyhow, so they go to the South with this appeal. They say, you know, black farmers and white farmers should get together. There was a whole whole part of the movement that historians called the black populists who were on board with this party, et cetera. And this triggered this incredible beatdown from the master, the ruling class of the South,
the planter class.
Bourbon Democrats. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They own the place, and they are propped up by this doctrine of what they used to call white solidarity. The idea being that what your interest as a white person is paramount to anything else, and white people have to stick together and have to vote for the white party, being the Democrats, of course, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they came down on populism like a ton of bricks. First, they cheated them. You know, vote fraud was very common in those days. I don't know about today, but back then it was a really ordinary maneuver. First, they did that, and then they just crushed them with this incredible racist campaign. And there's one southern state where the populists did manage to win. It was North Carolina. They got together with the local Republican Party, which was the traditional party of African American voters at the time, and they won. And they controlled the state legislature, had a U.S. senator, had a governor. And when they controlled the state legislature, they enacted various home rule measures. So all of a sudden in North Carolina in the 1890s, in the areas where blacks were in the majority, or just there were a lot of them, they could elect aldermen, they could elect mayors, and they could do all these things all of a sudden. Okay, so the local Democratic Party goes, am I allowed to curse?
Yep.
Yes.
They go absolutely apeshit. And they pull out the biggest weapon they know of, which is racial panic, racial fear-mongering. And they unleash this on populism and on the Republicans who had come together. They called this movement fusionism because they had fused together. And they called this, what the Democrats did to them, they called it the white supremacy campaign. And they weren't just fooling around, just like calling. That was their own name for themselves.
Right. They were out front about
campaign.
It.
Yeah. And they, you know, there's this hysterical campaign of fear against populism and the Republican, the fusionists.
Wow.
And they won. In 1898, the election of 1898, they finally beat these guys. And as soon as they did it, they disenfranchised black voters and a whole lot of poor whites. And by the way, they did this all across the South. Up until
right.
that point in Southern history, in most Southern states, blacks were still allowed to vote.
Mm.
But once populism came along, it showed the sort of ruling class of the South, you know, this is really dangerous.
Was a flex of the muscle.
And they weaponized race.
Yes.
For class ends.
Yeah, of course.
Which is actually...
Yeah. This was absolutely a class conflict.
Right.
This is breaking out all over America. This is the original class conflict in our society. And it involves farmers and industrial workers versus the owners. Whether it's we're
right.
talking about Southern planters or Northern bankers or the Vanderbilt family that owns railroads, you know, et cetera. This is the original class conflict. And they weaponized... race to smash the party of farmers and of working people. And they did it. And then they disenfranchised a huge... And in some places, it actually got worse. There was a... This is extremely relevant right now. In one city in North Carolina, when this was done, they actually had a military coup. Do you know about this?
No.
It's the only successful coup in American history, if you discount the Civil War, if you put the Civil War aside. They'd beaten the populists and the Republicans, what were called the Fusionists. And in this one town, Wilmington, North Carolina, the local Democrats went further. And they got guns, and they went marching through the black part of town, shooting people indiscriminately, burning down buildings, chasing people out. They threatened to the city's mayor was a Republican. They got rid of him. The city's police chief was a populist. They got rid of him. They threatened to lynch all these people.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I didn't even know this story until a few years ago. And it is fascinating to me that and by the way, nothing happened to them. They threw out the mayor and the leader of the mob, the Democrat Party mob, installed himself as mayor. Yes. And nothing happened to him.
Oh, my God.
Worked. It was successful.
When people think of the U.S., they don't think of that.
That story.
Yeah.
Well, and it is we still can't talk about that story straight.
I mean, people you're talking about Black Wall Street, right?
The
burning down of that. Like, I just learned about that recently, and I'm in politics 24/7.
I only found out about this. I thought I knew about populism. I didn't know this story. I only found out about it a little while ago.
Wow.
Because until very recently, it was referred to as the Wilmington race riot.
Mm. Oh, like it was both sides.
Yeah.
Right, everybody
right.
did
Classic
right.
propaganda.
Everyone
no, this
did
was
some
a,
things,
a,
and they all regretted it.
White mob of former Confederate soldiers marching through the black part of town, shooting and burning. We still, by the way, and now we're in this period where people do talk about these things more openly, but they still can't tell the story right because one of the victims is
populism.
And they
right.
can't,
yeah.
that just bursts people's brains when they think that, wait, populism wasn't the mob?
Right.
So, wait a minute.
Populism was the victim of the white supremacist
mob. So what?
Let me ask you this question, because this is definitely relevant to this story. One of my biggest fears today is that you can basically have all, like, the class conflict that's very clear in society. I feel like there's this interchangeable thing that happens, and the media certainly plays into this, that it's almost like cultural grievances are just swapped for class grievances. And then there's like the supremacy of the cultural grievance. And what I'm worried about is, unless we're relentlessly focusing on class.
I remember somebody wrote a book about this.
but my question is, what if the worst case scenario is true, which is like they could just always kind of quash the class grievances by just pivoting to the culture war? That's my question. And I feel like that's the nightmare that we're in right now.
Yeah, in some ways it is. And well, that was it. Look, I tried to write the history. So the populists they deliberately avoided the culture war issues of their day. The main one being prohibition.
Right.
Of alcohol, for those of you who don't know the history of this part of American life, but they deliberately didn't talk. They never talked about this because it was so divisive, and it would have fractured their following,
their coalition, sure.
And eventually they did. They lost anyway for reasons that we just described, and then a bunch of other things that happened to them. But populist movements, some of them have been extremely successful. You think about the 1930s, the labor movement, the cultural populism of that period, Franklin D. Roosevelt, the New Deal, overwhelmingly successful. But then at other times, it's been very, not easy, but it's been possible to short circuit when people try to build movements that bring working class people together. It's turned out to be relatively easy to short circuit those. Look, this is the story of what's the matter with Kansas, is that these class grievances are buried under a mountain of culture war crap.
Yes,
right.
And this is what I discovered when I started writing that book. I was like, this is a long time ago now. I was drawn down there by the state's war on the theory of evolution, which was just so bizarre. Right. I couldn't believe it was happening.
Yeah.
And then I interviewed all the leaders of the sort of conservative movement there, and they were all deep in the culture wars. The culture wars were all they cared about. Mm-hmm. And what I eventually discovered was that every single one of the culture war battles was expressed in terms of class grievance. Mm. Every single one is about you, the honest, hardworking American citizen, versus this shadowy elite on the two coasts who are trying to tell you what to think, these Hollywood people, these New York people that are telling you
It's a brilliant bait and switch if you think about it.
Trying to tell you how to live.
It's truly brilliant.
It is brilliant. I don't know if it's done deliberately. I don't think it is. I think these things manifest. I mean, there are some geniuses behind it all, right? We think back to the Nixon days. Spiro Agnew. This was, the people who were behind, like Kevin Phillips, Pat Buchanan. These guys are really good at the game. Who wrote Spiro Agnew's speeches for him? But you see it all there in miniature. This is transforming class animosity into culture war.
Yeah.
They were very good at it. And it's still with us. I mean, it's everywhere today.
So
it's all around us.
How do you see the events of last week then? And how does that fit into populism, the history of populism, anti-populism? What's your view?
Okay, next question. what can I say that hasn't been said? It's absolutely, it's terrifying. It's atrocious. It's not populism. Populism does not mean mob rule. It doesn't mean demagoguery.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean Donald Trump.
He's a successful fake populist, I'd say. He's like the ultimate fake populist.
Right. There's a kind of there is a kind of phony populism.
Yes.
What I was just talking about, where you capture people's class anger.
Grievance.
Yes.
Yeah. And which is a legitimate grievance in my view.
Right.
But you capture that with these other tools. But God, those people on the Capitol are the people who ransacked the Capitol. There have been now a couple of efforts to interview a bunch of them and see what their causes are, what they think. Other than, we know what their main cause was, right? They want Donald Trump to continue being president. They think he won the election.
Right.
And
really think that.
Yeah,
like, really believe it.
Isn't that?
Well,
yeah.
But here's the bottom line is that they appear to me to just be there. Some of them, we know what they're like. If you're carrying a Confederate flag, we know what you believe in.
Right.
Yeah.
You're making it really super plain there.
But what about the guys carrying South Vietnam flags? What the hell's up with that?
Well,
did you see that?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
Crystal and I were talking about this the other day, and there's like dueling narratives going on now because some people, like Professor Richard Wolff, for example, who I love and who eventually we'll have on this show and everything, he's making the argument that, like, actually, yes, the economic grievances are driving a large number of the people who were at Capitol Hill that day. So there is an argument for, like...
Oh, wait, Kyle, I want to interrupt here a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
So I've spent a lot of time with these kind of protesters. Mm-hmm. Remember, I used to write about the Tea Party movement. Republicans, Trump supporters aren't just working class people.
Well, that was what I was going to get to. I was going to say that the other argument is some of the people who were there were CEOs.
Yeah.
Woman flew in on a private jet.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a mix. It's messy
is my point. Of course.
Yeah.
And they're all over the map. They come from all over the country. They had to travel a long way. So when I used to hang around with the Tea Party people, these were small business people.
Right.
Now, they were they did something very interesting, which was to try to capture it was a performance. They were trying to this was 2009, 2010, mm-hmm. so we're in the Great Recession. The economy has collapsed. Wall Street has done these things where everybody's angry. Remember, and we've bailed them out.
Bailed them out.
And they've committed open,
bonuses.
Obvious fraud,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. And nothing's happening to them. And these people get together and manage to capture public anger about it. It was kind of a genius move, but it wasn't working class people at those rallies. These were small business people, a lot of lobbyists, actually.
Yeah.
Chomsky said the anger is real, but yes, there's an astroturf element to it where it is some people who are kind of steering the movement who are pretty well off.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is like it's a messy situation. There's no clean, neat
exactly.
narrative that
so
fits
there
it.
Is no there is no great sociological
right.
breakdown of it. And I would caution anybody, you know, against saying that this was some kind of
pure
working class
revolt
protest.
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
I've been at a lot of strikes. Mm-hmm. You know, those are working class
yes,
protests.
Absolutely.
Well,
you know?
And what I have seen that has been worrisome is, and it actually ties into painting everybody there as a working class person, is then people who want to consolidate elite control use this image to say, this is what populism is. We
yes,
can't have
yeah.
this. Mm-hmm. We can't have these people. These people are crazy,
yeah.
right? They're ransacking the camp. They believe in utter insanities and delusions. They worship this crazy, maniacal guy. Like, we can't let these people run anything. And then that's yeah. used to yeah. quash legitimate majoritarian populist movements.
And wait, I want to point out another sort of shocking aspect of this is that it's largely Democrats that are saying that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is the putative party of the people, the political party founded by Thomas Jefferson that has totally lost its faith in ordinary Americans and denounces them all the time, wants to control them, wants to censor what they – and I'm –
it's the core of what they do now and what they stand for.
Yeah, what they want to censor what we see and read. They want us to – I mean, I was just reading some asshole today was saying people need to – they need to swear that they'll wear a mask or something before we'll give them –
yes, you know, I
benefits.
Saw that.
That was
Twitter.
Kyle, yeah. actually.
Was it? You know, it's like that's – you know – look, there's a larger historical issue going on here that, you know, these riots. By the way, and I don't want to downplay the importance of this. I've studied fascism and I've studied like right-wing terrorism in the 1970s when I was a kid. It was around, not in this country, but like in Italy and
yeah.
Spain and other places, South Africa. And this could be the beginning of something really dreadful. I mean, only a handful of people got killed during this, which is amazing.
Right.
That anybody got killed, but they got inside the Capitol, mm-hmm. right?
I still can't. That still boggles the mind. But
I
we'll
think
talk
it's
about
the
I'm
cops.
I'm not an expert on this stuff. And
yeah.
I wasn't there, and I haven't read. Anyhow, the thing is, this could be the beginning of something really awful, and I don't want to brush it off, and I don't want to diminish the significance of it. This could be the start of something really, really, really bad. But it also could be the last gasp of Trumpism.
Well, I was going to say, so do you see, like, so we have Biden, and then do you see, like, a more competent demagogue like Cruz or Hawley winning in 2024? Is that the fear?
Yeah, those guys might be done for. But look, Trumpism is not going away.
Right.
Everything that we've just described,
yeah.
the substituting of cultural grievances for economic ones.
Right.
And then Trump added to that. Remember, Trump actually did talk about
I'm not going to cut your Social Security.
Grievances.
We got to
yes.
stop outsourcing the jobs.
Yes.
No more outsourcing.
Exactly.
NAFTA was the worst trade deal ever signed. Yeah, of course.
No, then he didn't do.
Didn't do anything. Yeah,
I was about to there say.
Was net
I was about to say jack shit. But
right.
I keep forgetting. The FCC might not like that. What the hell? Nobody gives a damn
anymore. Whatever you want, Thomas.
Yeah, whatever you want.
It's so funny. But you know, when I was young, you had to be very careful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You okay?
Back
I
certain?
Threw my back out. I was, yeah.
You want a cushion or something?
No, I'm
okay.
fine. I just
okay.
got to, I've got to sit.
Okay.
A certain way.
Perfectly
gotcha.
Still. No gestures.
I've even. Done that and it's horrible. So what does all of this mean?
But wait, there was a question that I was, of yours that I was going to get back to, which is
okay.
this broader problem of this mistrust of ordinary Americans
right.
that you see. And, you know, Republicans have said things like that forever. What disturbs me is that it's now in the Democratic Party, that the Democratic Party has come to identify itself with credentialed expertise.
Hierarchy.
With hierarchy, the people at the top, with the elite. I mean, let's use the word, with the elite in a way that I've never seen before. And that is really disturbing. And that's not how, I mean, you can try running a left-wing movement that way, or a party of the left that way, and maybe that will succeed, but it's not going to be a party that does any of the things that I'm interested in doing.
Right.
And this is the story of our times, is the, you know, Trumpism is a reaction to that in some ways.
Right.
Yes.
But what burns me up all the time is that you've got one party that is this pseudo-populist, this fake, these, you know, fake class-based uprisings and appeals to people whose lives really are being destroyed.
Right.
You just drive through any small town outside of one of the big cities. You know, I just drove through upstate New York yesterday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was driving through Vermont and stuff. And when you're outside of the fancy ski resorts and the big cities and all that, these people's lives are being destroyed.
Right. Yeah.
And they have a right to be pissed off. So Trump appeals to them in this really awful way. And the Democrats turn up, which is ordinarily the party that would be speaking to them and trying to do something about their situation. The Democrats turn up their noses at them,
yeah,
and shake their fingers at them, scold them. And they've become a kind of, well, the term that I use in my new book is that certain kind of liberal inhabits a utopia of scolding.
Mm.
And I'll unpack that if you want. But it's like, I don't want to go on too long because I know you have another question.
No,
and I have
going.
A problem with, I just talk too much.
No, we like you, it. Go.
It's because you have
please,
a lot to say.
On.
Go ahead.
So what we're seeing in this country is, okay, so not only are they sort of, you know, I always used to say there's two hierarchies in America. There's one hierarchy of money, you know, corporate power, and there's a hierarchy of credentials, of expertise, mm-hmm, of you know, the professional elite, people whose affluence is
based, I went to the right schools.
Yeah, is based on their achievements in school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but no, they have, you know, they have, we're here in a building named for a very famous professional association.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lawyers, doctors,
cultural
academics.
Power,
yeah,
too.
Well, it comes from their achievements in school, from credentialed expertise. And they are an elite just as much as the hierarchy of money, you know, Silicon Valley, Wall Street, et cetera. What's really alarming is right now, those two elites are coming together. Okay, this is something I've never seen before in my lifetime. So it used to be that the corporate elite was on the Republican side and the sort of credentialed elite of professional elite was on the Democratic side. And they're, I mean, we're in a situation now where they are uniting. And that is disturbing. I mean, it's disturbing if you're on the left because the situation that I've just described.
There's no workers'
who's
party.
Who's left out? Yeah.
There's no workers'
what's
party.
What's missing from this picture?
Yeah.
Us.
Well, and what does that mean? What does that portend for the future of a stable society if you have two parties of the elites and no mass popular expression? Nobody is representing the interests of the
it's
workers.
Incredibly
no
unhealthy.
Union representation either.
Yeah, that's right.
And well, it used to be the Democratic
talk about
Party.
Yeah.
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 Right.
Look, that is a great question. And the way I like to put it, and this is, I think of this as the theme of my entire life as a writer.
Mm.
Is what happens to a middle-class society like the one I was born into? What happens to a middle-class society when you no longer have a party of the traditional left? When that is gone, when that is removed from the equation, which happened in this country, that's Clintonism. I mean, that's Carter in some ways, but that's the Democratic Party has said openly, we're not interested in being that party anymore. We don't want to be the party of
organized
workers. We don't want to be the, you know, we don't want to be the party of poor people. We don't want to be, you know, they're not interested in that. They're interested in something else. We can talk about that something else later. But what happens when, you know, the party of the left gives up on its traditional role? And as far as I know, we're one of the only – well, it's happening all over the world, but we're way ahead of everyone else.
Yeah.
So what happens to a society like the one – I was born in 1965. You had a very broad distribution of wealth, at least in the northern states. especially for white people, but also for a lot of black people as well. This was – America was basically a social democracy.
Right.
And not in the South, of course. But in like where I grew up, yeah, the you know, there was not a huge divide between the rich and the poor,
mm-hmm.
or the rich and the sort of blue collar working people. Well, what happens when the party of the left gives up on that? Well, two things. First of all, that's all gone to hell. You have incredible inequality. And you know the statistics from this our COVID that what is it? Jeff Bezos.
Yeah,
now the richest man in the world, his wealth increases by some incredible amount every day. He owns our newspaper.
60% of small businesses that shut are permanently shut.
I believe the stat was he could have given every single Amazon worker a $125,000 bonus and still have made money during the crisis.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, but it just gets worse. And it was already extremely bad before any of this began. I used to, we've been talking about this for a long time. But it just gets worse and worse and worse. That's one thing that happens. And the other thing that happens is Trumpism. Is that you have these demagogic right wing, you know, the Republican Party is now looking around for ways to, you know, to get elected. And you'd have to be, you know, a complete political dunce not to see that this spells opportunity.
Right.
Look, the Democrats have, and by the way, Nixon could see this back in 68, the Democrats are abandoning their traditional, the people that they've been identified with forever. They're abandoning them. You'd have to be, you know, it would be political malpractice for them not to reach out and try to win these voters over in some way. And that's precisely what they've done for 40 years now.
Yeah.
And they have succeeded at it. It's just, it's absolutely maddening. But it's a recipe for disaster.
You know, I learned something very interesting that you taught me today. I didn't know that 85% of newspapers, roughly 85% of newspapers, were anti-FDR. And so what I took away from that fact is that it wasn't just the corporate elite and the moneyed interests who were lined up against him. It was also the cultural elite that were lined up against him.
Oh, yes.
So that triggered the thought for me that in some ways FDR was like a left Trump, right? But who actually meant it?
He was a real populist.
Yes, he was a real populist, right? But so my question for you is, because we do have some lawmakers today who are elected who took no corporate PAC money, took no big money, only raised through small dollar donations, nominally in terms of what they believe in, it's a social democratic agenda. So they check all the boxes on that stuff. But one of the problems that I see from them is that they're terrified to actually lean into having the media hate them. And they're terrified to lean into sort of like the cultural battle here. They'd rather align with the cultural elites as opposed to be opposed to the cultural elites. So if you have a left that sort of leans into that battle with the media, do you think that would yield better results? And can you get like a left Trump who actually succeeds on some of these things?
Well, the answer is yes, you could, but they don't want to do that. That's the memory of the 1930s is so distant. It's so forgotten.
Right, yeah.
That whenever I remind people of it, they're like you. They didn't know it. They're shocked.
No idea.
So just to fill in the to tell the whole story. So Roosevelt was elected in 32, the deepest level days of the Depression. The day he was inaugurated, all the banks in America were closed, for example. Yeah, it was a complete economic catastrophe. And nobody really knew in 32 what he meant by New Deal. Sometimes he would spell it out, but it was fairly vague. And so a lot of the American elite was with Roosevelt in 32. By 1936, they know what he means by it. It means he's going to break up the banks. He's going to regulate the remaining banks. He's going to set up the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's going to be breaking up monopolies. He's going to, he's going to have programs giving jobs to unemployed people. You know, he's going to be raising wages all over the place. Unions are forming. It's like it is doomsday for capitalism, right? So by 1936, they know what this guy is up to. And the election of 1936, the American elite came together against him in this incredible way. And when I say the American elite, I mean all of them. I mean not just the rich, like the DuPont family, the richest family in America, who bankrolled the first great right-wing front group. They were called the American Liberty League. They had more money than the Republican Party year.
Wow. Yeah.
But the rich were with the Republicans. The newspapers of America, like you said, 85% of them, estimated 85% of them were against Roosevelt. And they denounced him in the most extreme kind of way. It is reminiscent of the anti-Trump feel. Like, you know how at any time during the last 4 years, you could open up the Washington Post and there'd be 8 op-eds denouncing Trump.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And nothing else.
Yep.
Every single story.
Everything else in the world is ignored.
Yes.
You know? Well, it was like that in 36 against Roosevelt. Just constantly. The Chicago Tribune, which was one of the biggest papers in America at the time, would denounce him on page one, these page one political cartoons. I mean, the most extreme kind of rhetoric, calling him a communist, calling him a subversive, all of this. On and on and on. But the sort of professional elites of America were against him. The lawyers, the American Bar Association, all these guys, the preachers of America. I'm leaving. Economists.
Right.
They hated him. But I'm talking about orthodox economists here. Harvard, you know, MIT, the people who are in charge of the profession.
Yeah.
Roosevelt had his own economic advisors, people like John Kenneth Galbraith, who are really, really outside of the mainstream. And they were trying all kinds of new things. But orthodox economics, along with all the other professions, they absolutely hated this guy. And yeah, they came together against him in this extraordinary way. And Roosevelt proceeded to win in one of the biggest landslides of all time.
Wow. You said it made people like him more, right?
Yeah. Leaning into it, that's exactly what he did.
Yes.
He would go on the radio and he would talk about this, that they all hate me.
That's so gangster.
He had a term for them. He called them economic royalists.
Oh, that's such a good term.
Which is so great, right? You know, and he said, I welcome their hatred.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful. And he just wailed on them. But he also had the radio. So he had that wonderful voice and he could go on the radio and be very reassuring. And the public loved him. And there was not really a study by our modern day standards, but somebody at the time went back and read all the newspaper coverage and said that back then cities used to have more than one newspaper. And they said that even in cities where all of the papers were against Roosevelt, those were the cities where he did best.
Oh my God. Awesome.
Which indicated that not only did people like Roosevelt, but they hated the media so much.
Yes.
Yes.
Which they still
just
do.
Like today. There just was, like today. Exactly.
There was actually, this history I had no idea of either. There was actually a piece in the Washington Post about how business leaders and elites tried to foment an actual armed coup.
Right. So I didn't talk about that in the book because the evidence for that is very poor.
Mm.
But it's captured the imagination and people talk about it all the time. This was, I forget who it was. It was a guy from some Wall Street broker. And he had been, it's actually kind of an interesting story. He had been on vacation in Europe.
Uh-huh.
And he'd been hanging around with some guys in Italy, and he'd been learning.
Picking up some tricks and
some
techniques.
Guys in France, and he had learned all about this great thing called fascism.
Yeah.
And he came back to America. So we only know little bits and pieces of it. We don't know the whole story.
Yeah.
But he came back to America and evidently tried to encourage some of his other business friends to mount a fascist coup, okay? Now, this never got anywhere. It was apparently, as far as we know, it was one guy sort of like spreading.
Cooking this up.
Yeah, yeah. Dreaming this up on his own in his spare time. The stuff that I'm describing, like the American Liberty League, this was real. And they were giving speeches all over America and they were issuing pamphlets and they were on the radio all the time and they were doing black tie banquets here in D.C. where the owner of the Washington Post would be there and some, you know, exiled royalty from Europe would be there. And, you know, what killed these guys is that the American Liberty League is that they were totally upfront about their elitism. It's like we represent America's best people.
It's sort of like the Democrats, though, now.
you, meaning the voters, have to learn to stay in your place.
Right.
And what is just absolutely, you know, blows your mind when you go back and dig through the original materials from the 30s is they were right up front about this. They would talk about eugenics.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. They're like, well, the reason you are in the working class and I am here at this fancy resort speaking to my fellow professional attorneys is because, you know, I'm the result of good breeding.
Oh, wow.
And you are down there because your ancestors are like a bunch of fuck-ups.
Today's liberals stop a step short of that. They don't quite go that far. But
they were open about this. They would, like, publish this stuff. And the, you know, can you imagine trying to make a political sale by denouncing ordinary people?
Right.
Like, it's like, it's so stupid. It boggles the imagination. But they lost. We never learned that lesson, though.
Yeah.
And we are right back to that today. I mean, now we do it in slightly more subtle terms. But when you see one of those yard signs.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
And say, respect science. Well, you and I, we've been to college. We know that's not what the scientific method is. It's not a matter of respect. Yeah.
Right.
It's a matter of questioning.
Fealty.
And trying to poke holes in a hypothesis, et cetera. Testing an idea. That's not what they're talking about. Respect science means respect credentials, respect
yes.
me.
Right. Yes.
Right.
Know your place.
Sort of like the deification of Fauci, for example. There's this, the Democratic, like, they love him so much. It's so fawning and so over the top. Meanwhile, early on, he said that you shouldn't buy masks.
He outright,
yeah, I know. Well, look,
outright lied about it.
One of the things that we all know is experts make mistakes. I make mistakes, and I'm not going to go. I mean, I like Fauci personally. I've never met him or anything, but I like him. But I do have to point this out again and again and again. This is something I'm going to point it out to you, and I every time I get a chance, I tell whoever I'm talking to about this. We are living in a time of incredible cascading elite failures.
That's right.
One after another, after another, after another. Depending on when you want to start, you want to start with the Iraq war, you want to start with the financial crisis, you know, you can list them. And these are failures by credentialed authorities, by, you know, by professionals, by people at the very top, bailing each other out, never holding each other accountable, getting us into stupid wars, or look at, you know, mismanaging Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. And this one always makes me chuckle because she was advised by the very smartest people in American politics. Mm-hmm. And they lost to a guy that had never run for office before, whose campaign was managed by Steve Bannon, who had never managed a campaign before.
Right.
And they lost to this guy.
And they learned no lesson from that.
Right. But you goes on and on and on. Elite failure on top of elite failure on top of elite failure. But there's nobody saying, oh, we need to do something about our elites and the way they keep screwing up. There is no sort of program of study for that. There is no handy term for denouncing these people. Instead, it's always about populism. And this goes way beyond the events of last week at the Capitol. This is the last 5 years, both in America and in Europe. All of these intellectuals crying and gnashing their teeth and tearing their hair because the people don't trust them,
the experts,
anymore. Yeah, mm-hmm. people have lost faith in the experts. And wait, the answer that, and they talk about this all the time, constantly. It's in the newspaper every single day here in Washington. But one answer is off limits to them. Can never be explored. Can never be discussed. Can never be acknowledged. And that is the possibility that of elite failure.
We fucked up. Yeah.
Right.
No, that can't be the answer.
No.
It's like they do it the opposite of the way.
Facebook ads.
Yeah.
It's got to be.
Always Russia.
How would a scientist approach this? They'd be like, what's the simplest answer for why people hate elites?
Occam's razor.
Because elites keep fucking up.
Well,
but they're, you know, they won't use that answer.
Right.
It has to be this really convoluted thing about how everybody is deluded, everybody's been tricked. And
Trump has been an amazing excuse because it's just his fault.
Yeah.
It's just his fault. Yeah. There was no, like, any, he just popped out of the ether, and he magically made everything horrible. Nothing was horrible before. It was all going great. Bush era was amazing. He's a hero, right? This just popped out of nowhere.
And I think that's one of the worst things about the time that we're living in is that I came out of academia. I got a PhD some years ago, and they are as enlisted in this culture war now as anybody else. I never thought of them that way, but it certainly seems like they are now. And that's singularly disheartening to me.
So let me ask you this. This is a question I've been thinking a lot about. Is it worth it to take head on the myth-making and the deification of Democratic figures like Bill Clinton and Obama? Because Bernie strategy in 2016 and in 2020 was to almost just leave that off the table completely. Like, let's not get into Bill Clinton's legacy. Let's not get into Obama's legacy, because Obama, for example, has a high approval rating, even though he was very neoliberal, corporatist, standard status quo type president. So do you think it makes sense to take on those sacred cows or no?
Well, speaking as somebody who is, writes books and, what you do when you're a journalist or an intellectual is you try to hold the powerful accountable. Of course you do.
Well, I mean, for politicians running, if you're a left politician running, trying to win,
is it worth trying to take on
the legacy of Obama to say, actually, no, he did a lot of bad things, like when he bailed out Wall Street and then they gave out bonuses and then they didn't even limit it.
By the way, we're speaking on the morning that Biden just announced his economic plan, or I guess that was last night. Mm-hmm. And that is itself a sort of repudiation of Obamaism. It's more than twice as big as the stimulus that Obama proposed. And it's a tacit acceptance of the critique at the time that Obama's stimulus was way too small and too paltry. So whether they say it openly or not, they have to come to terms with that legacy. So I liked Obama, voted for Obama. I was happy with him. The one that burns me up is Clinton and Clintonism. And that is a legacy that they do have to repudiate openly, because that legacy is you think about Clinton's big five accomplishments as president. Okay, what were they? I always try to do them in order, but
welfare reform.
Welfare reform, the crime bill of 94, bank deregulation, which also telecom deregulation.
NAFTA.
Yeah, of course, the trade agreements. And it wasn't just NAFTA. Remember, he also got PNTR with China.
Right, that's even worse.
Which was much more disastrous.
And the crime bill.
And then the balanced budget. The crime bill. All five of those things were Republican proposals. All five of them. Basically, Clinton is made the sale for Republican policies. These are things that Reagan wanted. Reagan negotiated NAFTA.
Right. Yeah.
Or the Reagan's team negotiated it.
Yeah.
But they couldn't get it passed.
That was all Reagan.
All of these ideas were Reagan ideas.
Yep.
Deregulating Wall Street, all this. And Clinton got it done in this spectacular way. And that is a legacy that if we don't come to terms with what a disaster that was for the country and for the Democratic Party, then we are lost. And it is ironic to me that as we've gone through this last year of racial reckoning, which I think it really needed to happen, that somehow a lot of these Democrats are exempt from that. I mean, it's highly ironic.
That
Joe Biden was the Democratic nominee in the great year of Black Lives Matter.
No one really talks about the author
of the 94 crime
bill. That's right. Yeah.
And had a hand in a bunch of the earlier ones as well.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He's the nominee this year. It's like I have a philosophy of 2020. I have a way of looking at it.
What is it?
It's kind of vulgar.
That's okay.
You're free to say whatever.
So the Romans thought that the gods were very human, and that the gods liked to play with us like you and I would play chess. Mm. The gods would move us around, and the gods would torment us just for the fun of it, just to see how we reacted. And that's 2020. They're just fucking with us.
Yeah. It feels like it, right?
Like making Bernie drop out right before the pandemic hit.
Oh, my God.
I know.
So the guy who's proposing universal healthcare,
that's right.
Which would have been like an obvious thing once you realize what the pandemic is and what it's going to entail. Making Joe Biden the nominee.
And I want to dig in on what you were saying about how his stimulus proposal represents a certain tacit repudiation of Obama. I've been paying attention a little bit this week to Joe Scarborough on Morning Joe, who's like, direct line into elites in Washington. And it's been really interesting because this morning he was on there going like, here's how I argue in favor of universal health care to my conservative friends.
Joe Scarborough?
Very surprising, I know.
Yeah, and making this case earlier this week, he was making this case about how FDR was right on that we've got to have these reforms in order to save capitalism. Otherwise, this whole thing is going to fall apart. And I'm watching this going, what the hell is going on here?
That is interesting.
Isn't it interesting?
Is he still a Republican, by the way?
Allegedly.
He's a Biden Democrat.
He sees himself as conservative, right? Or at least plays it up that way. But I thought that, and you've seen Biden on embracing $2,000 checks. Now it's $1,400 plus $600, whatever. Embracing $2,000 checks. embracing a larger, I think, stimulus than we expected, and certainly a lot larger than the Obama era. I mean, do you think that there's any kind of a recognition there that they got to give some scraps to the working class or else this is going to end badly for them?
Yeah, I look, I don't know. And we all know what it's basically. They've taken everything that's been floating around in the ether here in Washington for the last year and threw it all together into a proposal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's great. It's massive. It includes everything. But it's not enough by itself. There's going to have to be a lot more reforms that happen. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see whether Biden is an interesting guy because he does identify with unions and with blue collar people. You know, he likes to tour factories. You know, he likes
to speak.
He's got
the affect.
He's got the affect, but his record is still
very poor.
Clinton-esque.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you know all the excuses people make for him. They're like, well, Biden is a party man, and so he does whatever the leadership tells him. And now that he's in the leadership, he gets to do whatever he wants.
The new FDR articles I think are insane. But
yeah.
To Crystal's point,
it would be nice, wouldn't it?
I would love it. Are you kidding
Cheers
me? Prove me wrong, Joe.
I just want to throw one thing out there. If Biden does it. Right. If he pulls a Harry Hopkins kind of – Harry Hopkins was Roosevelt's advisor who was able to get relief money out to people with incredible speed, set up the WPA, all this stuff early on in the Roosevelt era. If Biden's able to do something like that and get everybody vaccinated in the first 100 days, get money out to people in the first 100 days, this country will love him.
Oh, are you kidding me? We want to love somebody.
The bar is
it would be so
low.
Great to have
Give
a leader.
Give me one universal program. Give me one universal program. Yeah. And everybody be like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Put him on Mount Rushmore.
Exactly. That's a great opportunity.
It is.
This guy could do it. And he's got both houses now. And if he knows how to play the game, and supposedly he does, right? He can do the Lyndon Johnson thing and twist people's arms.
Fingers crossed.
Get people to vote for things that they ordinarily wouldn't vote for. If he's able to do that, he has it in his hands.
Yeah.
Now, unfortunately, I have a sort of gag reflex when I start to be optimistic about Democrats.
Yeah, no, you
because
can't
I remember
be. No,
what
no.
happened last
you
time.
Know
expect the worst.
Drama
I expect
is
the worst.
Coming.
I mean, just Obamacare is a great example of this, right? Like, Obama and the Democrats ended up ultimately proposing the conservative reform because that originally came from the Heritage Foundation.
Right.
Exactly. And it was Romney Care.
They negotiate with
Bob
themselves.
Dole's, right. Bob Dole's alternative to Clinton.
Exactly. Newt Gingrich supported it back in the day. So, like, that's always what I come to expect from the Democrats.
Well, yeah. I mean, even on the $2,000 checks is a perfectly illustrious example.
Like, I meant
$1,400. On this super clear, like, amazingly clear, you know, Facebook ads that literally say, vote for Reverend Warnock and you will get a $2,000 check.
Yeah.
And then before they
Well, you already got 600 of
it. Before they even take it,
a total. We meant a total of 2,000.
Like, well, I mean, 14 plus the 600, and if you count in, it's like, no, you have a political winner. You've made a
but
promise.
But wait, they also say, but that's what Trump meant when he proposed it. So we're just doing what Trump.
Yeah,
isn't it funny when Trump stakes out the left wing of the acceptable?
Yes,
exactly. And that issue was dead until Trump re-injected it back into the conversation. I mean, credit to
Bernie,
Hawley and Bernie. Yeah.
By the way, every time we say Trump's name, you have to say that asshole.
That asshole. That's correct. But to your point, Crystal, to the point about Morning Joe, which I think is actually really interesting that he is doing this turn right
and
now.
By the way, he calls himself a populist now.
Oh, what?
Trump.
I didn't hear that.
I swear to God.
Okay.
Trump?
Yeah. Yes, he called no,
Trump
no.
or Morning Joe?
Morning Joe.
Oh, my God. That's the
calls
craziest
himself
thing
what?
Ever.
I swear to God.
I can't believe it either. But anyway, my question based off that is
I'm sorry if I'm going to make you watch Morning Joe.
It's
all right. Out of curiosity.
You guys have to understand, I don't watch TV anymore. I'm not invited on TV. In this country, I'm not, like, I'm totally persona non grata. In
you and Noam Chomsky, you're not allowed on, yeah.
But it's fine. I don't care.
You
I
feel
really
better,
don't care.
Right.
I'm able to do good work. I'm proud of what I do. And they buy my books in Australia, so I'm happy.
I buy your books, too. I recommend everybody buy your books. But my question is, do you remember the author who was on Morning Joe or no? Do you remember his name? I don't remember his name. It's okay. It's no big deal. Anyway, this author basically framed FDR's successes as like the thing that saved capitalism, and it was good for capitalism. And so I think that's the framing that kind of triggered Morning Joe to be like, yeah, I like capitalism.
Well, that's
so,
okay. That's a classic take on FDR. I think it's kind of a bullshit take.
Okay,
it's
something I was going to ask you what you think of it.
I mean, if you asked the capitalists at the time,
they would be like, oh.
They were like, this guy's a red.
Right.
Yeah. He's exactly. A commie. He's in league with the Russians, et cetera, et cetera. They did say that.
Yeah.
And they didn't think there was any saving capitalism about it. But people said that in the 1950s, you had this new generation. We can talk, they talk about this in relationship to populism. New generation of historians that came up. They were called the consensus school. And for them, political divisiveness, like you saw in the 1930s, was anathema. And they tried to erase it from American history. And the idea was that all American politicians throughout our history, with a few tiny exceptions, have agreed on everything. And one of the things that they supposedly agree on is capitalism. Mm. So therefore, FDR has to be reconfigured as a savior of capitalism.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
So, but is there value in that framing, though, for like normie Americans? Or is it largely a negative to do that, to frame it that way?
That's not my business.
Okay.
The thing is, the you know, it's true in the sense that he saved America from some kind of something worse. So imagine, Herbert Hoover is a sort of disastrous president, doesn't do anything as the, sort of like Trump, actually.
Yeah.
He doesn't do anything as the crisis worsens. I mean, you think of Trump over the last year, did jack all
about
COVID. It's just, it's so, by the way, he would have been easily reelected if he had shown in just the slightest bit of leadership.
He'd even pretended to be doing anything. Yeah.
Like Cuomo. Cuomo's a high approval rate. He's just pretending.
But since the election, I don't think he's talked about it at all.
No.
He only cares about like, you know,
stop
I really
steal.
Won. It was the whole thing's a fraud. It's like, what the hell kind of politician is this?
Yeah.
Anyhow, where were we? Oh, Hoover.
Yeah.
So imagine if Roosevelt had been another Hoover, which could easily have happened. The fact that you get this man who's extremely energetic, totally fearless, willing to try anything, that you get the right man at the right time, that's kind of extremely fortunate. If you had had a second Hoover and everything just continued to tank,
we could have became fascist, right?
Or communist or anything.
Right.
Yeah. Who knows? It could have become. I mean, anything could have happened. So,
let me ask you,
are fortunate in that respect.
Let me ask you this question about that era. So all the elites align against Roosevelt, the cultural elites, the experts, the moneyed, everybody's like, we hate this guy. And the public's like, we love him. And he gets elected and reelected resoundingly. Do you think that elites have consolidated power to the point in this country where that would actually be impossible? So
it's happening right now, though.
Right.
I misunderstood.
No, so what I mean is, look, with Trump, he's able to get elected. He has this, you know, somewhat grassroots base, but he also has an elite plutocratic agenda and consent and support and enabling from an elite class. So he's able
to
get
taxes.
Cut tax, deregulation, all of this stuff. They get their judges. They got exactly what they wanted out of the deal. So you have an elite class that supports him. Whereas if you look at like a left-wing movement, like the Sanders movement, you only have the grassroots base, and you have zero elite support, and you have 100% elite antagonism. Are they just too powerful to overcome at this point, or is it still possible?
Ooh. Look, I try to be a hopeful person about things like this. The Sanders movement was really inspiring. We can sit around and talk about what they did wrong. You know, I don't really want to get into that. There'll be another Bernie Sanders. This movement, I should say. Let's talk about first. Let me acknowledge the downside of this. The elites are together in this country. We've talked about this already. The elites are together in this country right now in a way that we've never seen before. With Biden outraised and outspent Trump by a considerable amount. So did Hillary Clinton. Republican areas all over America, the affluent Republican areas are shifting over to the Democratic Party. You've been seeing the reports of traditional Republican donors cutting off Republican politicians.
Yes.
This is incredible.
All these corporations,
happening.
Right.
And in some ways, look, nobody likes to see Republicans go down you know, more than me.
More than all of us.
This,
right.
is, this is, in some ways, this is great. But you're also seeing a coming together of the elites, a gathering of the elite tribes like we have never seen before in our lives. And that's scary. Okay, to get back to being hopeful about the future. Let's see, why am I hopeful about the future? Oh, yes. I'm older than you guys. I'm 55. I started the Baffler magazine in 1988. All those years that I was doing that, we were alone. I mean, there was and you know, our ideas were extremely unpopular. And you know, I was at the Wall Street Journal when Obama became president, and I was the odd man out, believe me. And I've always, my entire career has been, you know, predicated on the assumption that I am basically all by myself. Well, not anymore.
Not anymore.
I mean, you look around. There's like all of these people. You know, movements on the left are growing and building, and the support for Bernie is incredible. This is a man. I interviewed him in 2014. Mm. Maybe it was 15. It was before he declared his candidacy for the presidency, and. Everybody just assumed, well, this guy's a crank. You know, he's going to run a kind of Ralph Nader campaign, you know. And look what he did.
Look what he did.
It's fantastic. Better than I could have ever thought possible. His message is clearly resonating. It's wonderful. And so I am very hopeful about that, that these ideas are catching on and they're all over the place now. And I'm very positive about that.
So do you think that there will be – as we just described, there's this elite consolidation behind the Democratic Party. Do you see a Republican civil war now happening?
Oh,
the Trumpists versus the establishment types?
Yes, but in some ways, it's already happened. You know, it's at some point, you know. Do you think Mitt Romney will actually switch parties?
That's a good question,
like
right? I mean, he
or
doesn't have the base of support in the Republican Party.
Yeah, well,
anymore.
He's not running for president again, so
yeah.
But the so maybe he won't. But I think that it's a Trumpist party now. Now, I don't that by saying that, I don't mean that a member of Trump's family or some of these people who really discredited themselves in the last couple of weeks are going to be the nominee next time around. What I mean is Trumpism did not start with Trump. It started with Nixon, or you can go back further than that. But it's basically this. It's what we were describing earlier, coming up with non-economic ways to speak to people's economic grievances. Mm. The culture wars are the preeminent example, but racism helps out there too. And you know, there's others. They have all sorts of weapons in their, you know, in their mixed metaphor here. Weapons in their
arsenal.
Yes, yeah. I was about to say toolbox. Yeah. That's not where you keep your weapons. But Trumpism is older than Trump, and it will outlast Trump. Trump just took it a few steps further, both in his extreme demagoguery, you know, and the vulgar language, and the very interesting thing that he brought to the table was the genuine economic hints of economic populism,
yeah.
Especially
trade,
on trade agreements,
issues, yeah.
Which then he did very, very little to advance.
Right.
I mean, those towns that were suffering, they're still suffering.
Yeah, 100%.
Those people that were screwed, they're still screwed. I mean, the only thing he did really to help those people out, he didn't do, which is he had a booming economy. And you started to see wage growth before COVID.
Right.
And now that's all gone. And then so.
Yeah, that's all gone. So.
Yeah. He only has 30% left, though. That's the interesting part.
Oh, this last move, this was a disaster for him.
Disaster.
Right.
So he probably can't run in 2024 now, right?
I mean,
I was more worried about one of his kids running.
I don't think they have his talent. I really do think he's talented in a very specific way. I think he knows how to read a crowd and rile them up.
He fascinates me because on
me
the
too.
One hand,
yeah.
he's so stupid.
You know,
I'll tell you his
trick. His trick is he's punchy when he talks. It's very quick, abbreviated sentences. It lands. And it's a way of speaking where anybody could sort of, because he was made fun of for talking at like a sixth grade or fifth grade level or whatever it was. I remember reading articles about that.
No, that's not when I say he's stupid. What I mean is that like he couldn't figure out to be a leader during COVID.
Yeah, he's a dumbass. I agree with that.
And it, you know, he goes around insulting huge parts of the electorate. Remember? Calling Mexicans, what, rapists and murderers?
Right.
What?
Right.
Yeah. What kind of politician does that?
Saying it's only old people who die of COVID? Generally, old people, don't worry about it.
Or making fun of handicapped people. Do you remember that?
I do remember that.
That one blew my mind.
Yeah.
Like, what politician does that?
But you know, the best thing about him is what you were saying about Roosevelt. This goes back to your point about Roosevelt. The best thing about him is the people that hate him. Like, that is actually the appeal of Trumpism, is like, all of these people that I fucking despise,
I hate
this guy, and now I love him.
Yep.
I mean, that's the whole thing.
And by the way, Democrats can't figure this out.
No.
Have you ever looked up what people actually think of Hollywood? If you go to their conventions, they bring these people out one after another, and it's like, everybody loves a Hollywood star, right? No.
I do think there's truth to that narrative of, like, there's a lot of political correctness, and so whoever stands up and says, I don't agree with the political correctness, people are like, I'm with this person. You know what I mean? And that's a simplistic narrative, and it's brought up way too much to cover everything. But there is an element of truth in that, and I think that explains a lot of Trump's appeal.
Yep. The vulgarity, I have a different theory, which is that he's an excellent performer. And so he was out there giving speeches in whatever, 2015, 2016. And when he would get a reaction from the audience, he would, put a mental check mark and repeat that.
That's right.
And then finally that would become like the trade agreements. If you go back and look at his speeches, that was his main theme.
That's his main theme.
By the end.
In the right states, too, where he was campaigning.
And it's like, well, how did that happen,
Yeah.
Because audiences would roar when he talked about that.
Yeah.
And so he figured out, that needs to be my thing. And just trial and error, some kind of...
Yeah. Chomsky made a good point. He said that what Trump does that's genuinely skillful is he knows how to sort of appease the people who are lower income and make up his base, while also simultaneously appeasing the corporate interests that helped fund his campaign and that he served with the tax cuts and the deregulation. And that's not an easy thing to do.
That's George W. Bush also, that's Ronald Reagan. That's all of them. That's Newt Gingrich. That is the trick to being a Republican.
Yeah.
Remember, George Bush Sr. is the one that always makes me laugh because he was such an aristocrat.
Zero charisma.
So bad.
Yeah. But he went around the country in 1988 eating pork rinds.
Oh my God.
Conspicuously eating pork rinds and hanging around with country singers and touring flag factories. Remember this?
Yes. Well,
that's ridiculous.
Oh,
and then the Democrats give him this perfect opponent. Michael Dukakis is like, it's not about ideology, it's about competence.
Amazing.
I'm the greatest technocrat that the world has ever seen.
John Kerry versus W. Same thing.
It's the same thing.
Same thing.
We always fall. We always walk right into the trap. Always.
It.
Not we. The Democratic
Party.
Yeah, the Democrats.
Always walks right into the trap.
So if
Hillary Clinton, same deal.
Elites are now wholesale abandoning the Republican Party, at least making a big show of it. And I do think that it's going to be harder for fundraising. It's going to be harder for those who want to go back to the country club or get their corporate deal after they're out of office. I think that life is going to be harder for them in their, prospective career path and what they were planning to do. So if you have continued elite consolidations you've been talking about in the Democratic Party, does that mean that you ultimately do have more and more working class people, white, brown, and black, drifting over to the Republican Party like we saw this time around?
Well, look, this was something that I wrote in years ago in What's the Matter with Kansas, that this kind of phony populism, this appeal to class grievances without talking about economics, that this is powerful, especially in the absence of anything else, especially if the Democrats aren't giving you the real deal, which they aren't. That this will eventually migrate. I mean, by that time, it had already gone from – there used to be a demographic group before, back in the 70s. They were called – the term of art back then was the white ethnics.
Mm.
And they had been a part of the Roosevelt coalition, the New Deal coalition. And in the 1970s, they shifted to the Republican Party. And this basically is what I was thinking when I wrote this, is that basically eventually this will happen. What you just described will eventually happen, that these kind of culture war appeals will eventually spill over into groups other than the what we now call the white working class. And you will see other groups being roped in. Now, I did not think that it would happen while Trump was the leader of the Republican Party, because he's such an asshole. He's such a bigot.
Right.
I didn't think that it would happen, but I thought it would happen eventually. But it was my great surprise then the election just concluded. Well, you saw the Latino voters in Texas and Florida, all over the country, shifting dramatically to the Republican Party. That's really interesting. If that continues, that's going to change the map.
And now, do you think that does come from?
Oh, I'm sure it's – look, I don't know. I haven't been to those places. Mm-hmm. It's COVID time. I haven't interviewed anybody, and I don't do that sort of thing anymore.
I read it might have been the checks. Remember when they sent out the first round of stimulus checks and I had Trump's name on it?
And they were – and that worked?
Well, that's Latino just, voters that's would get the just, check and say Donald J. Trump on it,
yeah,
and you
now
go,
just imagine
okay.
if he'd actually been a real leader during COVID. It, you know, that might have been – look, that's just simple retail politics there. You know,
exactly,
that's,
yeah.
He just did the right thing,
yeah,
you know,
right.
for once. Mm-hmm. But look, there's no reason why it wouldn't eventually happen. And this is the fallacy. And remind me, I want to talk about the group that's going the other way, that's going to the Democratic Party, because these are the people that I grew up amongst. But this is the great fallacy of the Democratic Party strategy. And you know what the strategy is. They call it the coalition of the ascendant, meaning, you know, all of these different demographic groups that are growing in numbers rather than shrinking. And they're becoming Democratic. And so the Democratic Party says, look, we don't have to do anything. We got it in the bag. We're eventually, if we wait long enough, we'll be unstoppable.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have to do anything. We don't have to serve anybody. We don't have to, you know, do anything for anybody, except for, of course, the professional elite who they love and adore and will do no end of favors for.
Yeah.
But we don't have to do anything for these groups that are coming our way.
Except say we're not racist.
Yeah, well, call the other side names. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
But
we're not bigots. Vote for us.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's kind of true.
Right.
Yeah,
that's,
no,
that's
true.
Better than it's the just, other people's pitch, which is we are racist, but
the
it's
idea,
an anti-pitch.
The idea of not actually delivering
yes,
anything to these people.
And
by the way, this is a subject that is coming up more and more and more. Do you remember, in this last election, did you saw this rant from Ice Cube, you know, the rapper?
Yes.
Did you
mm-hmm.
see
that?
I thought that was awesome.
It was awesome, yeah.
But he making this point. He's like, well, what have you done for us?
Yeah.
What are you actually
Give
going
me something
to do
tangible.
Other than beating Trump? You know, come on. What else you got?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a totally normal question. But the Democratic plan is literally to take people for granted. Remember the sort of unofficial motto of Clintonism in the 90s? Where have they got to go?
Yep.
Where else are they going to go?
You got no other choice. Yep.
And that's the Democratic strategy. What it leaves out, because these guys are really bad at chess, what it leaves out is, what's the other player going to do? You know, he's not just going to sit there and let this happen to him.
Right, yeah.
He's going to come up with something.
Right.
We don't know what, but Trump just showed you what it is.
Right.
Which is reach out to the white working class who are already on their way into the Republican Party, but accelerate that, you know, the what's the matter with Kansas phenomenon. You know, push that along, and next it'll be other groups. Of course it will. There's no question about it. But they're dynamic. They're going to be reaching out. They're going to be doing everything they can to make sure that this doesn't happen.
Right. I feel like the good news might be, though, that Trump may have taken it a bridge too far into, like, conspiracy territory, where it's like,
well,
now, the other aspects of the message are totally overshadowed by what just happened. You know what I mean? Like, the economic stuff, I think in his 2020 run, he wasn't anywhere near as economically populist sounding as he was in 2016.
That's right. But can I just throw something out there, like a digression? Hasn't it been a relief for the last week to realize this guy's done?
Yes.
Yeah.
I saw 29% approval rating right before we came in here. That's what I saw. And I was like, I knew it. So he's going out like Bush. He's going out like Bush.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fantastic.
I know.
It's
that's Bush time. Territory.
Yeah. I mean, he had it all in hand. If he just kept –
Oh, he's
of all,
so bad at the game, though.
If he'd even been remotely of a leader in COVID, like you said, reelected, no problem, running against Biden, who was, you know, let's just say less than ideal candidate.
Barely alive.
So could have easily gotten reelected. And then even after he lost, if he just kept his mouth shut, he had his post-presidency, could have made tons of money, could have played the will he or won't he game for 4 years about if he's going
to
run.
But no, he had to.
Now he's got no friends.
Now, no friends. He may have to declare bankruptcy. This guy may end up in prison.
Deutsche Bank abandoned
him.
Just
like
got off because he encouraged a little riot.
Right.
When all the corporate interests are like, sorry, man, we're done. We know you cut our taxes. We know you deregulated, but we can't do it.
Well,
he's like, oh, shucks.
No, done. You know, what else are you going to do for me? Looks like nothing, so see you later.
Yeah.
All he had to do was not do this, and he would have been fine. I mean, but he did this.
We were both chuckling about how the thing that he was most upset about was the PGA.
Yes.
Pulling the championship.
He was most
but
upset
actually,
about that.
It's kind of real because, like, when the elites are officially pulling their support, and you're screwed without that. He's totally screwed without that.
Do you think he's going to go to jail with the New York?
Oh, come on. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't do any of that sort of thing. But just to go back to his folly as a politician.
Yeah.
And so in the one sense, like we said earlier, he was able to beat Hillary Clinton in 2016 when she outraised him by 2-1 and had the best advisors in the world, had, you know, everything going for her, and he managed to beat her, and it is amazing. And he also beat Jeb Bush, and he beat all those other guys. It is amazing.
Yeah.
But you look at this last campaign, the Democrats choose Joe Biden during the great year of Black Lives Matter, and Trump can't figure out how to, like, it's like, wait a minute, you just chose the guy who's responsible for, like, destroying the lives of one of your single most important, you know, demographic support. And Trump can't figure out how to, like, turn that against him.
Right.
It gets better because Trump would contradict himself instantly when he would campaign. Yeah, in the same sentence, because he would attack him for being too hard on crime with the crime bill, but then he would immediately attack him as too soft on crime. You got
to
pick one.
But that's very Republican to say contradictory things in the same sentence. Yes. I kind of admire that.
He'd be like, he funded the police too much, but he's going to defund the police.
He couldn't make the sale. The thing is that, because he doesn't understand it. He doesn't have any problem with the crime bill of 94. So he couldn't figure out why someone might be against that. And he couldn't show empathy, couldn't understand that. And I'm sitting there saying, oh my God, this is Biden is totally exposed on this.
Yes,
totally. Vulnerable. And you know, the dude can't figure out how to drive it home. So we got lucky. You know?
He's half alive and he won. I mean, COVID really was
nice.
The thing.
We're all thinking nice things about Joe Biden right now.
COVID was
it's
the thing.
It's going to be great, like, to have a real president.
Oh, yeah.
I'm very excited.
He just needs to stay
the
whole of America,
shut up,
Thomas.
Mr. Frank. I don't want to go down the Obama hole that I went down in 08 where I was like, I was all full of hope.
We all were to some extent. Yeah. But
Biden just needed to stay home and shut up, and then Trump self-destructed. That's it.
Yeah. That's all. Yep. That was the whole scene.
That and COVID, and you go, oh my God, let's go with the guy who didn't fuck this up royally. That's the idea.
That was it.
The FCC heard that. The Attorney General heard that. Here's the other side of the coin. So I grew up in the sort of white flight suburbs of Kansas City. They're not in Missouri. They're in Kansas. It's called Johnson County, Kansas. We were not a wealthy family, but we grew up around some of the richest people in America. You know, that lived in that area. Very, very affluent part of the city, part of the state. This is the ruling class of Kansas City. This is the ruling class of the state of Kansas. They run the place. Okay, and when I was a kid, well, I wrote What's the Matter with Kansas largely about these people. These were the most Republican people in the world. These people had voted for every Republican to come down the pike since, like, Taft, right? The only one – so Woodrow Wilson was the last time Johnson County went for a Democrat, and then it was rural. It wasn't part of the city then. But these were extremely Republican people, of course. That's what Republicans were.
Right.
The ruling class. They own the place. Right.
Right.
And they have their country clubs, and that's about it.
Right.
This area, by the way, is called the Country Club District.
Oh, geez. That's too perfect.
I'm not kidding.
That's too perfect.
I know. Anyhow, Biden took it. For the first time since Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, won this area. And I went back. I went into the data the other day. And in the neighborhood that I grew up in, the ruling class of the city, the ruling class of the state, Biden won every precinct. Every single one in that little part of Johnson County. And it blows my mind. And this is – and everywhere you went in my neighborhood where these – I went out there for Election Day, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's an annual ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And everywhere you went were these, you know, Black Lives Matter signs and those yard signs saying respect science and you know, all of this stuff. And it's incredible. And this is the ruling class changing sides. We are seeing it before our eyes, and it is absolutely fascinating. I mean, the most Republican people in America, And now it's like, you know, the working class people in Wichita. That's who votes for Trump. Right. There's more of them. Trump still won the state because there's more of them. And then farmers, of course.
Right, yeah.
There's more of them than there are of. But it's a complete inversion of the way things have always been. So like Kansas went for Roosevelt. You know, Kansas went for Lyndon Johnson. Johnson County didn't. My area didn't. They went for Goldwater. They went for, you know, Landon or whoever the hell it was.
Right.
You know, but the rest of Kansas. But now it's completely flipped. All those people, the sweating, toiling masses of the state went for Trump, and the owners went for Biden. It's absolutely
mind-boggling.
Anyhow, this is the future. This is where we're going.
So, and this will be my final question for you, then I'll turn it over to Crystal. But what's the best way to get workers' interests back into the mainstream of American politics? Is it through some third-party route, or is it through unions getting more involved? Is it through some sort of general strike? Like, what's your view on that?
I sounded like my own father when I made that noise.
Kyle, let me go.
I'm like mine too.
I'm sorry. I hate getting old. It absolutely sucks. I think, look, one of the things that needs to happen, it's a catch-22 situation, because the obvious answer is unions. You need to, you want to trigger a kind of 1930s scenario, let people form unions again in this country. And most of your viewers probably don't know this story, but one of the reasons that the Democratic Party is so weakened and is changing before our eyes is that unions have been they're no longer – I mean, when I was a kid, that's what the Democratic Party was.
Right.
It was the party of organized labor. Everybody knew this. It was obvious. And today, they aren't. And unions are very, very weak. They're down to it's like 7% of the private sector, something like that.
Yeah, I think it's
6% or 7%. And that's because – of the way that the laws in this country are enforced. It's basically, you try to organize a union in the workplace, boss fires you. That's it. And that's against the law, but the law is toothless. And so employers have figured out that it's extremely easy to get rid of unions, to prevent people from starting new ones. And as a result, they are no longer an important, force in American life. And with the results that we talked about before, extreme inequality, the rise of this culture war, all of these terrible things are a result of that, ultimately. How do you change that? It's easy. You change the law, you put teeth in the law, you enforce the law, and people can start forming unions again, and they will change the face of this country. They will bring about economic equality by themselves, and also through politics. They'll do all the things that would be healthful, and it would be a good thing. Unfortunately, for that to happen, people in Washington have to let it happen.
Right.
They have to pass legislation. They have to start enforcing the law, etc. So that has to happen first, and the question is, will they do it? And it was on the table when Obama was elected.
Card check, right?
Yep. And Obama was like, sorry,
He did like a perfunctory, I tried.
Yeah,
I
did my best. See you later, guys.
Yeah.
And that's that. And it was, and the unions have tried with each Democratic president as soon as they're elected. So Bill Clinton, they tried something similar. Jimmy Carter, they tried something similar right at the beginning of the administration. And each time they were rebuffed, not just by Republicans, for whom they are the mortal foe, but by Democrats who refuse to lift a finger for them because the Democratic Party doesn't believe in that anymore. So you've got it's a very, very tricky situation. It's a kind of catch-22, but I think that's the obvious answer. If you were able to get them up and running again and they became a force, it would completely change the complexion of this society.
Do you think that there's reason to be hopeful there with Biden? Because he is this, I think he genuinely sees himself as like working class Joe in spite of all of his, or middle class Joe, I guess, in spite of all of his
the famous
terrible
euphemism.
Track record.
Yeah.
And he came up during a time in politics when unions were still the Democratic Party and having to be comfortable in the union hall and speak that language and understand at least that side of politics.
Yeah.
I don't want to force you to be hopeful, but is there any reason to believe maybe he would have more sympathy to that direction of the country than Obama did ultimately?
I think so. I hope so. But I don't know. Look, a lot of unions really thought he was their guy. And then, this is the face-off between him and Bernie.
Right.
And both of them were very pro-labor. Mm. Bernie actually has the track record.
Yes.
Right.
Biden's track record is not as good. But there are union leaders who really think he is going to go to bat for them. Now, we're all going to find out. I don't know the answer to whether he will or not, but there are certainly a lot of people who think he's going to, and exactly what you just described, middle class Joe, all that stuff. I am not hopeful about it because if you watch their convention, they almost never talked about it.
There was no labor.
So I'm older than you guys. I've watched a lot of conventions in my time. And the Democrats, it wasn't just labor. It was that term that you used earlier, middle class. They used to love this term. And they open up the Democratic convention and they immediately start talking about it. You know, we are the party of the middle class. We're about building the middle class. We're blah, 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 on and on and on. And this goes way back. And they always did this up until very recently here. If you watch their convention this year, they never said it. Mm-hmm. Or if they did, I missed it. They never talked about it. They what they wanted you to know was that they were the party of diversity.
Mm.
And that they drove that home in this really unmistakable way.
The Black Lives Matter blocks behind Elizabeth Warren.
Trump even tried to do that. There was very diversity was a big thing at the Republican.
Right. He had all those NFL players and stuff like that. But then you go to the Republican convention, and the very first speaker, right out of the gate, is like, "We are the party of the working class."
Yeah,
or something like that. I mean,
they had just nurses speak. So, they had workers, and small
and it's
business
all, and it's all, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but it's all bullshit.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But they said it.
Yeah,
and they get some kind of prize for that.
You can do people. Yeah. For sure.
I mean, when at least they're saying it, I guess, is from the public perspective, from the public perception, at least they're saying the words working class and middle class. I mean, I guess, where do you think that things go from here? Like, how do you think the Republican Party cracks up? Do you think that elites sort of break off from that in a sort of rump group and maybe form their own third party? Do you think Trumpism totally takes over the Republican Party? Do you think Democrats just continue down the neoliberal path? What do you see in the trends in terms of the direction we're heading in?
Two possible scenarios. One, Biden succeeds as president, and Biden basically cures COVID, and Biden gets the economy roaring again, and Biden is a hero, and it inaugurates a new era of Democratic Party dominance. Okay, that's the rosy scenario. Okay,
color me skeptical. Now
exactly. Now let's talk about what will probably happen is that Biden will trip up over his own reservations, Republican obstruction, of course, but also he'll be unable to overcome forces in his own party, or he doesn't want to. It'll be like Obama. Obama did a lot of things Obama could have done that he didn't do. It's because he didn't want to.
Right.
Right.
And let's say Biden is basically the same way. And so he delivers half measures in all things. It's another Obama term. Nothing happens. You remember in 2014 and 15, just nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did nothing. It was absolutely maddening. And that goes on. And yes, the business interests go back, or like the business interests that are aligned with the Republican Party go back to the Republican Party. So big oil, who else do they have? Big coal.
Yeah.
Well,
the energy sector.
Well, Sheldon Adelson just died. He's an industry unto himself.
They've got MyPillow CEO.
The what?
The MyPillow CEO.
Guy, yeah.
Big job creator, that pillow man.
I was going to say the casino industry, but it's actually just that one guy.
Yeah.
Sheldon Adelson. But let's say that business makes its way back, once Trump is out of the picture, they mend their fences, they come back into the Republican Party, and you get a kind of Ted Cruz figure, a Marco Rubio figure, who combines the Trumpist culture war stuff. By the way, they understand what we were talking about earlier, that you run against the media.
Right.
That is the sweet spot. They get that.
Right.
And so but they're also smart. These are intelligent guys. They know how to be a politician. They know you don't go around insulting like the biggest demographic groups in America. You don't go down your list of American ethnic groups insulting them. Well, they know you don't. You don't do that. You flatter them. You know, you do that. Anyhow, you get somebody like that who's competent, who's running, and say Biden has got very, very little done. You're going to have a fight on your hands. And look, if nothing happens, and we don't start reversing inequality, and we don't start like what I was describing in upstate New York or in out in Kansas or in Missouri, small town Missouri, anywhere that I've gone in the last couple of years, and you just see these once vibrant, you know, productive parts of America turned into a wasteland.
Yeah.
If we don't start reversing that, we're in huge trouble in this country, yeah. Not just because those people are suffering and those people's lives suck. You know, that's terrible. But if the only alternative presented to them is the party of professional elites who worship globalization and the internet, or this, you know, culture war assholes, you know, who just want to speak to your bitterness and your frustration, we're in huge trouble.
Yeah.
And I strongly suspect that is the way we're going, because ultimately I'm kind of a pessimist, and I think that's where we're headed.
But
let's hope that Biden hits a home run.
Yeah, all the indications.
From your lips to God's ears, sir.
No, the 78-year-old steps up to the plate.
and becomes a totally different politician than he's been his entire career.
Yeah, yeah. It could happen.
You never know.
It could happen.
He's just trying to survive, literally.
You never know. In theory, it's possible. The book is fantastic. The people... comma no the no yeah. It's phenomenal. Everyone,
the people no
yeah there you go.
And
that's
also I also just want to say, what's the matter with Kansas? Everybody should buy that book as well, and everybody should buy Listen Liberal. These are wonderful books. What's the Matter with Kansas was one of the first political books I read, and so, you know, there's a special place for you in my heart. You helped my political evolution. So
wait, I have one last short question, which is, what were the books like for us? I think both your books have been incredibly formative. What were a book or a couple books that were really formative for you?
Well, let's talk about authors. I mean, I read people from long ago. That's my
okay.
You know, so I read those populist books and stuff from the 1890s. But of contemporary people, I mean, he's gone now. There was a historian called Christopher Lash that I really admired. And this is a guy, he got a lot of things wrong. He was often, you know, making big mistakes. But in the big picture stuff, he could see what nobody else could.
Mm.
And we didn't get into this, the sort of academic part of the people. It's not academic. It's very interesting.
It's about
professional history and how the historical discipline has changed. And the sort of the big bad guy in my current book is a man called Richard Hofstadter, who was the greatest American historian of the 50s. Christopher Lash was his protege, and sort of picked up where Hofstadter left off and then realized, it's like, wait a second, you know, he got everything wrong. Uh-huh. And Lash wrote this wonderful book about Clintonism. It was one of the first times he was one of the first people on the left to turn against Clinton and to develop a whole theory of Clinton. It was called Revolt of the Elites.
Mm.
All right.
And he was sort of my hero when I was younger. Yeah. Him, Studs Terkel, a bunch of other guys.
Studs Terkel's amazing.
I love Studs Terkel.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you. So great to have you. We really
appreciate
it.
This was a blast.
This was fun.
We enjoyed it.
Thank you.
You guys drained me. I'm like, now I'm going to go faint.
Well, thanks for joining us.
We enjoyed it. So thank you.
You are welcome.
So that was fascinating. And, you know, the thing that was funny to watch him wrestle with is he wants to be an optimist. So he puts out there, look at where young people are, look at the Sanders movement, look at what's been accomplished. I was out there all on my own with these left-wing ideas. Now they're really mainstream and they're really popular. But on the other hand, he had a hard time avoiding the pessimism of the moment, which is that you've had this massive cascading series of elite failures. You have every trend that brought us to this horrific place only accelerated over the past year. And you have the supposed party of the people that has now, every brand of elites in the country has consolidated behind and into the supposed party of the people. So it's a troubling place to be.
It is. So let me ask you, would you say you're a long-term pessimist or an optimist?
I think if you're going to engage in politics, you have to be an optimist. Like,
really?
I do. Otherwise it's like, why do this? Why think about it every day? Why talk about it every day? Why do any of the like organizational work that you've done and that I've done if you don't actually believe that things can get better? So in that way, I am an optimist, but I have to admit that looking at the facts of the matter that as they exist right in front of us, I find it hard to make the case for that optimism.
Yeah. So, I mean, my take on it is, I just fully embrace the agnostic label. Like, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, you know? Like, in some ways, yes, I could give you what are educated guesses, and I could tell you what is probable and what's likely, and just follow the evidence, and wherever it leads, it leads. But there is something about, like, just talking about that that almost helps cement that coming to fruition. So I'm not, I don't want to, like, partake in making the worst things so. You know what I mean?
Manifesting, like, the worst.
I don't want to manifest
it. Potential outcomes.
Yeah, and I just want to, like, acknowledge the fact that we do have the ability to adjust course. Like, you know, and we do. Like, you know, Thomas Frank was saying, the Bernie movement is reason to be excited, reason to have hope. You know, there has been a decline, obviously, post the loss, and there's a million reasons for the loss that we could get into. But, like, yes, the energy is there, and it is more defined than it's ever been previously.
Yeah.
Like, there is sort of like an amalgamation of issues that make up the core of that movement, and it's expressed in a way that even when you go back to the Obama era, early on in the Obama era, 2008, for him, it was a lot more like vague and flowery. Whereas with Bernie, it's like universal health care, Medicare for all. And like he'll give you the actual policy answers.
Simple, straightforward, direct.
So it's in the ether. It's in the ether. And yes, the evidence points us more in a pessimistic direction. But I'm too hesitant to just call myself a pessimist, I guess, now. Because if you embrace that agnosticism, you're always leaving the wiggle room to then manifest the positive stuff to happen. You know what I mean?
So here's two concrete reasons to feel some optimism, if you so choose. One, I think that the introduction of direct cash aid has been of profound importance.
Huge.
Because we've had decades of anti-government rhetoric and politics where, you know, the scariest nine words in the English language are "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." That has been the reigning dominant ethos in both parties. And so when you have that in the ether day in and day out, and those are the politics, then people stop believing in the possibility of federal government doing anything. And if you watched over the course of this year, there was a lot of good reason to not have any faith in the ability of federal government to do anything. But with those checks, you know, they showed up in people's accounts. They were real. They were tangible. They had a measurable positive impact that you can see anecdotally and also through a lot of studies. They really had a measurable, profound impact on people's lives. And that's an opening, right? That means that people actually recognize, like, oh, they could do something to better my life. They just haven't wanted to. And I think that realization is extraordinarily profound. It's incredibly powerful. Obviously, the support for checks is remarkably bipartisan. I was actually talking to Andrew Yang recently, and I asked him about when he first started his presidential campaign. It was like no one even knew what UBI was.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Not only was it not popular, people didn't even know what it was.
I was against it previously.
So if you think
I had to be moved on it.
If you think about the profound change, now it has like 80% support for a one-time payment. It's like 60-some percent support for a recurring payment. That's a tremendous potential and good, and I think a change in the way people think. And the other thing that I think is really important is that Trump's going to be gone. And he has so destroyed politics in so many ways because he's made the possibility of change within the Democratic Party completely impossible because they can always just, there's no cause for self-reflection. Everything's the fault of Trump. You can't even criticize us even a little bit because we're not Trump. Like, you don't want, if you criticize us, you must love fascists, you must love Trump. So he's destroyed any possibility of reform or change within the Democratic Party. And he's also destroyed any possibility of solidarity within working class people because he himself is such a polarizing issue that you can't possibly get past. So I do think that the elimination of him from the political scene, and I do think that he's done, is a profoundly important thing.
Yeah, and I would say to add to your, you know, reasons for optimism here, all you really need is a spark. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I'm a believer in that. In
I
the
agree.
Sense that all you need is the right moment and the right person or people or group and the right argument. And like, yeah, then it could be a snowball effect and you're off to the races. Like, when if you think of like FDR, when he rose to power, it's like everybody was totally fucked. And then here comes this guy, and then they do the New Deal, and it's like, he just unfucked everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there's always that potential, especially at a moment like we have now with COVID, where I always butcher this saying, but it's something like necessity is the mother
of invention
or something like that,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, yeah, when we have a pandemic, when we have nearly 400,000 deaths, when we have effectively an economic depression, you know, it's at times like this where you get, okay, now all of a sudden UBI is in the is on the table and in the conversation, whereas previously it was unheard of to have that in the conversation. So I do, I am optimistic in that sense, and I am optimistic in the sense that, you know, I learned a lot from David Dayan's articles about what capabilities the president has just through executive orders.
Yeah.
And so there's always, like, in my mind, that escape hatch of like, well, if we just get the presidency somehow, then you can have a president eliminate student loan debt, legalize marijuana, expand Medicare so that everybody's covered, because there's a provision under Obamacare that says for emergencies, you can expand Medicare coverage to everybody. You could do that under the guise of COVID,
by
basically.
The, Bernie's looking at doing that, by the way, reportedly. We'll see.
Right. Well, reserve judgment on whether or not something like that actually happens. But bottom line is, yes, the argument of all you need is a spark, all you need is a certain moment, and then all of a sudden you could go from the depths of despair to like, oh my God, we're actually doing something positive. So maybe that is a reason for optimism. But I still want to hold on to the agnostic label because it makes me edgy and cool.
And that's what really matters here. Yeah, I think, look, the profound, Thomas Frank makes many profound contributions to this conversation, but the one he really, really gets and focuses on is what a danger it is when you have all the elites in the supposed part of the party of the people and what that ultimately means going forward.
That's true. And one more thing I want to remind everybody one more time, okay?
Yes.
This is the last show that they're going to get for free of Crystal Kyle and Friends, the last video that they're going to get for free of Crystal Kyle and Friends on the Secular Talk YouTube channel. So if you want to keep getting the video and getting it Friday night as opposed to Saturday night, where you'll get the audio, then go to Substack, $5 a month, and it's $5 tip per month, and then you end up getting the video and you get it a day early. And for everybody else, if you want to hang on and watch the audio on Saturday, we still love you.
I don't think they're going to be able to watch the audio.
Well, listen to the audio.
Yeah.
You had to do that, didn't you? You just had to poke at my mess-ups, didn't you?
Couldn't
you
help
love
it,
this.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, anyway, so that's everybody's, you know, last chance effort to keep getting the video and getting
and
it a day early.
You guys know you don't want to miss the video of the one and only Senator Nina Turner.
Yeah, that's going to be great.
So, yeah, good day. Thanks for watching, guys. We'll see you next time.